So our next speaker is Janet Warren, and she has a nice confluence, I think, at least in her title, of our the theme for the meeting on brain, mind, faith, and geoscience, and also metaphor. And I'm looking forward to hearing what she has to tell us. Janet.
So when I first committed my life to Christ, I was adamant that the whole evolution creation thing just was not an issue. And somehow here I am. And since I've been involved in the ASA and this whole so-called science faith war, I've wondered about the problem that we tend to privilege the analytic side of things and neglect the non-analytic, although the previous talk would just contradict that. Particularly, I feel there's been a neglect of the importance of figurative language, and I'm going to focus on that with respect to creation. I suggest our tendency to impose contemporary Western scientific rationalism onto ancient texts has led us to an impoverished and possibly inaccurate view of biblical creation. And it's led to some false dichotomies on both sides of the debate. So you've got the sort of, Bible versus science images that people are fond of. Okay, so the question then is, why do we do this? So before I answer that question, this is the brief neuroscience part of it, and unfortunately, actually, my talk last year was on this, so really sorry if you missed it, the two-minute version. So neuroscience has increasingly recognized that there's two general neural pathways in the brain, ways of viewing and processing the world. There's a rough correlation with the right and left side of the brain, but now it's known to be not that rigid anyway. So the rational brain is mediated by conscious appraisal, justified by evidence, uses serial processing, and allows us to solve complex mathematical problems. So scientists are going to use it a lot. It also allows us to just navigate our surroundings. The non-rational brain, on the other hand, not to be confused with irrational, by the way, distinguishes surprising from normal events, makes automatic associations, focuses on existing evidence, detects subliminal messages. It's mediated by experience, and it uses parallel processing. So the automatic processes allow us to turn to a sound, initiate the fight or flight response, do easy computations. Both of these processes, however, have limits. Neither of them is perfect, and they can lead to errors in judgment. However, it's generally agreed that we need both processes to function normally in life. Now, in the ancient world, including the world of the Old Testament, they certainly wouldn't have been lacking in analytical skills, but I believe that they tended to favor the non-rationalistic or holistic imaginative way of thinking. However, our contemporary world, probably influenced by the Enlightenment and the Scientific Revolution, has esteemed analytical processes. So philosophers of modernity, for instance, made a sharp distinction between logic and imagination. So logic was considered to encompass truth, knowledge, and progress, whereas imagination was often deemed false and superstitious. So there was a general distrust of experience, imagination, and figurative language, and this false dichotomy developed between logic and imagination, between reason and faith, and between intellect and emotions. And it resulted in some neglect and misinterpretation, false dichotomy. And again, here's another common example, and don't worry about the details, but for example, they use a passage and say the Bible, Jeremiah talks that there's innumerable stars. Well, the context was that he was saying the descendants of David would be as countless as the stars. So, I mean, he wasn't really talking about the physical universe. He was using it clearly as an analogy. So then they somehow interpret that as, but looking at science, they only saw a few stars, and now we know there's innumerable stars. So it's basically nonsense. There have been some recent improvements. I think the idea of the two books is, you know, making some a step in the right direction, but I think it also misses some true integration between the two. And there's also a tendency to approach the Bible with sort of the scientific, logical lenses. So science and theology do speak different languages. However, they actually both use figurative language and the imagination. So there has, in recent years, been a move towards imagination. A lot of contemporary biblical studies really focus on figurative language, theology, and science. And there's increasing recognition of different types of knowledge. So in theology, Paul Avers, for example, states that the greatest truths can only be expressed in imaginative form. Science is noticing now the importance of intuition and that metaphors in science are needed because a lot of times we're talking about unseen realities. There's an increasing recognition of the limitations of science. So science cannot deal with unique events. Science is limited to testable phenomena, and truth in science is always provisional. And even Einstein recognized. By the way, I don't read my slides, you may have noticed, because I figure you can read quicker than I can read it out to you, and that would be redundant. So Einstein actually was ahead of his time in noticing the importance of figurative language. So I suggest that a further recovery of non-analytical knowledge can actually assist in our endeavors towards the integration of science and theology. So I'm going to move along and talk more about figurative language, starting with some boring definitions. So a little bit more detail on symbols. Symbols are dynamic, they're universal. They often originate in our universal experiences of life. So examples such as light and darkness, water, death. In science, pi would be an example of a symbol. The cross is an example in Christianity. Now, metaphors are ubiquitous, and they're often unconscious. Metaphors are essential for explaining new concepts. We have to have something new, we have to be able to compare it with something that we know already. Common metaphors in science that we may not even recognize. So we live in an elegant universe. Apparently, we have selfish genes. The cosmos is like a string symphony. Now, models can be seen as larger variants of metaphors or metaphorical systems or sustained, extended, systematic metaphors. And they can be, I'll talk more about theology ones in a minute, but they're common in science as well. For example, the model of the atom. Now, what's been recently discovered is that it used to be thought that metaphors were simply substitution or ornamentation, but it's now recognized that they actually have a cognitive power and they go beyond simple substitution. They guide our thoughts, as not just our language, and they have semantic power. They are able to depict truth and reality, often, in fact, better than literal language can. And that's key because it's still commonly thought that something is just a metaphor, a mere metaphor, and it's dismissed as being untrue, whereas often it actually is giving more truth than literal language can. So the pioneers in some of this work was Lakoff and Johnson and their book Metaphors We Live By, and they noted that metaphors can provide new meaning and assist with the organization of concepts. So a common one we may know of is the idea that life is a journey, and it incorporates other metaphors like babies arriving and the dead departing. So conceptual metaphors can help us organize our experiences and our conversations into a multidimensional structured whole. Another example is the idea that time is money. So we live on borrowed time. For some of us, that delayed flight cost us an hour or more in some cases. In science, we talk about the world being a machine, the brain being like a computer. The internet information is a web. Electricity is like water. It has flow and current. The key thing is that metaphors have semantic power and depict reality. So metaphor works because we know one realm better than we know another. So unseen or spiritual realm can be described using images from the physical realm. And metaphors often, as I mentioned, cannot be reduced to literal language. They're non-translatable. So think about the breath of God or Jesus being the light of the world. or the idea of being born again, those can be difficult to put into literal language. Metaphors highlight significant aspects of the comparison, and they hide irrelevant ones. So Jesus is the bread of life. He nourishes, but he doesn't exist in loaf form. Interesting, metaphors can be twice true. So they have a literal historical meaning as well as a deeper figurative one. Often we need more than one metaphor or model, and they're often complementary. And I know this example has been overused, so forgive me, but the idea of light as being a particle and a wave is a good example of needing two models to describe one system. Ian Barber makes some interesting comparisons while noticing similarities actually between scientific and religious models. So in the Bible, in general, they're considered to have more figurative language than literal language. So biblical authors, in fact, used multiple metaphors with multiple meanings. They intertwined myth, symbol, and history and poetry as all as descriptors of divine truth. Historical events like the Exodus, for example, took on deeper metaphorical significance. And I often find that people are very inconsistent in what we accept as metaphor in the Bible versus not. So, you know, you don't find any arguments, is God a rock or is he not, you know, and have geologists doing comparisons. But somehow we get to Genesis 1 and we have all these debates about, what's literal and what's metaphorical. So let's look at creation now. My interest in this, I actually meant to say this at the beginning, I did my PhD of actually understanding evil, demonology and deliverance, and I actually believe that creation theology is essential to almost any other theology. So I used it to understand evil, but of course I ended up looking at a lot of creation in the meanwhile. So multiple images of creation in the Bible. Yes, this is a common illustration. And for some reason, Adam and Eve are always hiding behind the bush, and I can't figure that out. But anyway, a lot of people don't realize, but Bereshit, which is the name of actually the first book of the Hebrew Bible, in the Hebrew, there's no article. There's no the or a or in or anything. So there's many ways of translating it. So our classic in the beginning is not necessarily correct. I like the argument that it should be translated instead or to begin with. But that's sort of a little bit of an aside because we're not really talking about biblical languages as a whole nother issue. So multiple images of creation. And do note that it's not limited to Genesis. Often, all we think about is Genesis 1, and we forget about all the teaching about and images of creation in a lot of the wisdom literature and even some in the prophetic literature. And I think the scientific view has limited us and has led us to an impoverished view of biblical creation. So let's just look in, and this is from John Walton, many of you are familiar with, some ideas that are common in creation accounts from antiquity. And you'll notice that a lot of this is in common with Genesis 1 and 2. So when we do talk about Genesis, we need to think about its purpose. And its major purpose was not really about the origin of the world. So Old Testament scholar Westerman, Klaus Westerman, and a whole lot of other people said that, people, the Old Testament authors would never ask how God created the world. Peter Enns, you might be familiar with, he says, it's not about scientific curiosity, but it was more a question of national identity for the people of Israel. Genesis 1 describes the beginning of a relationship with God as king of the world. So the beginning is exemplary and normative. It's not necessarily chronological or causal. A common model of understanding of creation in ancient literature was this idea of temple cosmology. So in ancient Near Eastern literature, mountains were often venerated because they're thought to be the dwelling place of the higher gods and the place where people and humans and gods would meet, meeting place between heaven and earth, the place where divine decrees were issued and life-giving water flowed from them. So this temple is related to the mythic idea of Mount Zion and Eden, so where the temple functioned as a connecting point with heaven. In fact, the function of the cosmos was as a place for divine-human interaction. And think about it, if the temple is like a mini-cosmos, then we can switch it around and say that the cosmos is also like a temple. And interesting, there's a lot of textual parallels when you look at it. So the temple, and when I say temple, I'm talking about, there were a whole bunch of temples in the Bible, actually, but I'm talking generally to include the wilderness tabernacle as well. So the cherubim in the tabernacle matched the cherubim in Eden, and people would have recognized that right away. We're removed. We don't necessarily notice that. The lampstand that was contained in the temple and the tabernacle was shaped like a tree. So the tree of life from Eden, it reappeared there. The light of God, which is in Eden and in the beginning, was also in the temple. Also similar language. So in Genesis 1, there's seven speech acts in creation, but in the construction of the tabernacle, there's also seven speech acts. The role of the Holy Spirit, and there's a whole lot more. So again, let me just remind you, if we talked about the function of metaphors and models, to illuminate the unknown with the known. So people knew the temple, and then going back, and remember Genesis was written approximately 500 BCE, so it was at a time when people were very familiar with the temple. So when we look at the model of the temple, it can give us some ideas about the structure of the cosmos. This is just one illustration, and various people over the years have looked at a sort of mapping the temple to the universe. So some have said that the outer court, it's often done more in concentric circles, so the outer court is where humanity dwells, that the holy place corresponds to the visible heavens, and the holy of holy corresponds to the invisible heavens. So another Old Testament scholar, Ronald Simpkins, has sort of extended this model, and he's got two. So in his horizontal model, puts holy land in order at the center and the originator of creation. And then the periphery is symbolized by symbols of evil, actually, like the sea, the desert, and chaos. So you've got this sort of, you know, outward flow. And this can also be done to connect with the temple cosmology in a vertical form, which was actually the dominant one in biblical stories, and it relates, like I said, the sacred space to the cosmic mountain, the place of divine-human interaction. Now, this is something you commonly see. This is just from the internet, but it's a similar thing is used elsewhere as a way that this is how people viewed the world. This is where I actually disagree with some people, because I don't think we know that this is was their science, and this is how they actually viewed the world. When you consider everything I just explained about the symbolism of it, this really makes a lot more sense, seen as in terms of temple cosmology, as a symbolic understanding and not a literal understanding. And taking all these passages where they talk about these things, just like I mentioned with, you know, that first slide with Jeremiah and the stars, it does not necessarily correspond to how people saw the world. And I'm not sure we know, and I don't think people were stupid, but I don't think we necessarily know. Okay, so looking at some other models, Mark Smith, in his priestly vision of Genesis 1, talks about three models of creation. So divine power, divine wisdom, and divine presence. He notes that these models do interrelate. So the first model describes God's, the creation is a result of God's powerful victory over cosmic enemies. And it's found in a lot of Psalms, such as 89 and 104 and 74, as you can see. So the universe is a stage for God's battle against water. And water was personified. Actually, the Hebrew word for water, Yam, was the name of a Canaanite demon. So that would have been known in the ancient world, and it can be missing to us. I'm going on a tangent again. And there were monsters dwelling in the water, such as Leviathan. So you can see this is very poetic. describing, so it's got all the elements of Genesis 1 and creation in there, but there's a whole lot more going on than just some sort of a literal historical description of creation. It's a praise to God, and it's showing how he conquered evil. This is probably the best known model of creation, and some of you may know it corresponds with a lot of ancient Near Eastern creation myths as well. It's found in Job as well. So the divine victory at creation prepared a place for humanity. The second model, that of wisdom, also found in a lot of the Psalms and in Isaiah 40 as well, is creation is a work of a divine craftsman. Poetics, creation is infused with wisdom. And we know about the Proverbs 8 personification of wisdom. So that's Psalm. And again, you can see elements of creation in there, but so much more about God's wisdom. And in Job, you can see it again, just showing that, you know, God's one of the divine speeches from the whirlwind, where God's saying, you don't know, you know, the depth of my greatness and wisdom in doing this. Who can understand God? And again, you know, we this whole interaction, I'd like to see some science faith integration done around passages like this, for instance, which we don't see. It's at least I haven't seen yet. And then the third model describes God's loving personal presence. And this relates to creation as a temple. So God dwells in the temple, God dwells in creation. And creation is imbued with divine holiness. God makes his presence manifest in various ways from this heavenly temple palace. And remember, again, the tabernacle contained the bread of divine presence. So And there's also New Testament references. So particularly in John, he had God is walking among us. And in fact, the word is tabernacled. So it would best translates, I should say, as tabernacled, which would be fitting for, again, in Eden, where God walked with his people. And creation is often an occasion to worship. So Psalm 8 is a nice example. If you read through it, you can see Genesis 1 very nicely in it. It's like a priestly vision of Genesis 1. So unlike us, Western scientific world, which, like I said, there are definitely signs of change, we're often concerned with what's the right answer. The ancients were quite happy to have multiple models coexisting. They didn't have to have one. And that's what it suggests that we do as well. So in conclusion, I believe we should have increasing awareness of metaphors and the multiple models for creation. And remember, there's not what we see in the Bible is not necessarily the way people viewed the world in a scientific manner. They had different interests. They focused on the symbolic aspect. So I believe when we view the Bible with scientific eyes, we miss the richness and meaning, and we should be looking with the metaphorical eyes of our heart. Our interpretation can be barren, unfruitful, so like the situation in Genesis 1 prior to creation. It's empty and in need of more of filling. So the title of my presentation from Genesis 2:6, where God watered the barren ground, if we interpret it just as God's hand in the weather, we miss the rich layers of meaning. So the word can be translated as mist, stream, springs, or giving a drink to. And plus, of course, metaphorical associations. People, remember, in a dry land where agriculture was important, water was life-giving, and God gave that water. Ezekiel's visionary temple, the water, high mountain, again, mountain cosmology, water streams flowed from it, was full of God's presence. It would have reminded readers of Elisha's miracle of transforming bad water and barren ground. And of course, for us, it would think about Jesus and the living water. So this is, I like the message in some ways, the paraphrase of the Bible, but in many ways it's limiting. So it translates this passage as the whole earth was watered by underground springs. So you can see immediately by putting that almost a scientific translation onto it, it's immediately limiting it. It's doing it as an explanation, and you're missing the richness and the depth of it. So I suggest that we consider using metaphors as a tool for discovery, you know, in both science and theology and in the integration between the two. And I suggest that we use both analytic and intuitive approaches, both rationality and imagination, to understand creation and a whole lot more. Thank you.
Janet, that was the pig snout, I have to say. Any questions for Janet? Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Is metaphor necessary for understanding things?
Yes. Yes, for some things. I wouldn't say necessary for everything. I particularly for the Bible, and I think it's indispensable to our daily lives, as I was saying earlier, and for science too. Yep, so I would say it is necessary. I mean, yeah, in absolutely every little thing, yeah, you can find areas where you can survive without it. But I didn't even go into this, but it's called a dead metaphor. You're sitting at a table that has legs. That's an example of a dead metaphor, but it was originally a metaphor. So you don't even think of it as a metaphor anymore. So I suspect that a lot of times we're using metaphor and we're not even aware that we're using it.
Terry, you could talk about the fact that Einstein and Newton and others advanced science by using metaphor or brain art that way.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to be a basic human function.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe one more question. Give folks time to get to another talk. If not, I will tell you that this session does continue after a break, but we're going to move to Munson if you're interested in continuing the discussion about literature, the Bible, and science. We'll be in Munson after the break, after lunch rather, and there are three other talks going on, other sessions right now, if you want to go catch one of those. Thanks very much. Let's thank Clary, Janet.